Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, we'll visit some of Illinois' immigrant communities and hear the effect the Trump administration's immigration arrests are having there. And we'll learn what some are doing to help affected families. An Illinois school district tried something new, a ban on cell phones. How's it working? We'll also hear about a lawsuit that could reverse a major wetlands protection law. One of the bills state lawmakers will consider could reshape the state's prison population, and it was written by a debate class. A group of formerly incarcerated men have created a theater project. We'll go behind the scenes. We'll also find out about Illinois' circus history and visit the Museum of Post-Punk and Industrial Music. It's all ahead this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The high-profile immigration arrests that started last weekend have quieted the streets in Chicago's Latino neighborhoods. Many residents are living in fear. Some afraid to take their kids to school or even go out for a bite to eat. Michael Puente went to Chicago's East Side neighborhood, where 80% of residents are Mexican.
On most weekdays in the winter, Jonathan Vasquez's restaurant on Chicago's far southeast side is busy with customers warming up with the help from his specialty Mexican soups and burritos. Not on Monday.
Most of my customers are Hispanics and they're afraid to come, and they're off ordering delivery because they don't want to come out.
For the past 25 years, Vasquez has owned and operated El Charro de San Francisco, named after a small town in the Mexican state of Guanajuato. It's on 106th Street, less than a mile from the Indiana border. The East Side neighborhood has been home to Mexican immigrants for more than a century. Vasquez's restaurant is on the commercial corridor in the center of the neighborhood, an area he says is usually bustling. But on Monday, it was desolate.
It destroys your local economy because most people, they are afraid to go out because they don't know if they are going to be able to go back home with their families.
Vasquez says whether people are here with legal status or not, just about everyone in the neighborhood is afraid to be stopped by agents from immigration and customs enforcement.
The way they question people, it's very strong. Like they try to get the most information out of you. Even if you try to say, I have my right not to talk, or let me talk to my lawyer first, but the way they question you is not easy to stay quiet.
Sitting in a booth in El Charro de San Francisco is activist Anthony Martinez with a group called the Brown Berets. He says it's really important for people to stay quiet, but he knows that's hard to do.
They're afraid for their own families of what's going on and their friends, and it's very scary.
Martinez says undocumented people came to the United States for a better life, not to do bad things.
They're not here robbing and stealing, killing people, doing rapes and saying all the bad about what Trump calls them. But no, they're working. They're being hard workers here.
10th Ward Alderman Peter Chico's ward office is just a couple of blocks from Vasquez's restaurant. Chico is a cop on leave from the Chicago Police Department to serve on the city council. He says threatening undocumented immigrants, forcing them into hiding, threatens the fabric of the neighborhood.
Keep in mind that there has been undocumented here for decades. They're neighbors of ours. They're people who have paid taxes, who have contributed to the vibrancy of our communities. And I think that's get lost sometimes.
Back at El Charro de San Francisco, Vasquez says he will remain open no matter what.
I've been here for 25 years, and it's not the first time that we see this going on. So this is like going back with your ex. We had him before 4 years, so we have him again for 4 years. So,
ICE officials say the enhanced enforcement in Chicago will continue. Michael Puente, WBEZ News.
Across the country, immigrant communities are bracing for what's to come of President Trump's plan to launch mass deportation. Maria Gardner-Laura hears how residents in northern Illinois are supporting families who could be impacted.
Veronica Garcia Martinez explains to a couple how to fill out the guardianship form on behalf of their baby boy. Garcia Martinez is a local teacher. She's volunteering, though, on her own time and not in association with her employer. Since Trump's inauguration, she, along with other volunteers, have hosted walk-in sessions on guardianship forms in DeKalb.
It is a time and a place for people to come in and fill out appointment of short-term guardian forms where two people, volunteers, will sign as witnesses.
Individuals and groups across the country are hosting Know Your Rights trainings and informational sessions for undocumented families. At this session, they have available the document needed for parents to designate a temporary guardian for their child if they get deported. Garcia Martinez says more than 300 forms have been distributed locally so far.
It's not a solution, it's just a peace of mind. Because when people fear deportation, they don't necessarily fear the process of, oh my God, I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to be detained. They fear of, if I'm detained, what will happen to my child at home? Is my child going to know what to do? Or who's going to care for my kid?
One mother came to secure guardianship for her son.
Yo sé que pues la maestra, ella es la tutor, y yo confío en ella.
She says her child's former teacher has agreed to be his guardian. The teacher is someone she trusts. She says since Trump came into power, the undocumented community has been on high alert.
Pues ha sido difícil.
She says it's been difficult because there's been a lot of talks of sightings of ICE over here and over there. So the truth is, she says, now I don't go out. One of several executive orders pertaining to immigration that President Donald Trump signed is titled Protecting the American People Against Invasion. It gives immigration agents authority to deport all undocumented residents or what the government now deems as, quote, illegal aliens. Now, deportations can be carried out at and nearby schools, churches, and hospitals. These were areas that previously were off limits. At the event in DeKalb, one set of parents arrived with their two boys close to their sides. The father says they've talked to their sons about the need to designate a guardian for them.
Están los tiempos difíciles que vamos a tener que hacer un papeleo para que alguien más los cuide en caso que nos pase algo.
He says the times are difficult and we have to fill out a lot of paperwork to ensure that someone will take care of them just in case something happens to us. He says despite the fear, overall they're doing all right.
Ya no salimos lejos, no vamos a Chicago, no vamos a ningún lado distante.
He says we don't go to Chicago. We don't go anywhere at a distance. So we're taking care of ourselves the best that we can. Volunteers like Selma Science cut out laminated informational cards that describe constitutional rights for folks to grab.
So the red card is just something that they can slide under the door or hold it up against the window. That pretty much tells law enforcement that they're not going to speak to them.
With the last family leaving the session, the volunteers pack up the leftover forms. Garcia Martinez says they're looking at other ways to support their students.
We don't want kids to stop going to school. So can we come up with a program to get kids home so parents don't have to pick them up? Like, what can we do? Can we think outside of the box to support the community? This program here is thinking outside of the box.
Meanwhile, some school districts are developing or updating their own policy for the event that an immigration agent arrives at one of their schools. I'm Maria Garner-Lara.
Steve Gossard will tell you Illinois is a circus state. The former curator of special collections, including circus collections at Milner Library at Illinois State University, has made it his business to research the state's rich circus history. Starting in the 19th century, when the circus was the public's main form of entertainment, separate circus companies were formed in places like Bloomington, as well as other towns such as Galesburg, Quincy, Petersburg, and Danville. And he spoke about it with Steve Tarter.
Very few people knew anything about it. And I found an article that had been written by a retired trapeze artist named Clyde Noble for White Tops magazine in 1950. And it was just a nice little capsule of Bloomington Circus history. But it made certain claims about Bloomington Circus that I said, well, when did these things happen? When did they happen? How did they happen? Who did this and that? The main claim was that an act called the Flying Return Act had been invented in Bloomington by a guy named Fred.
This Noble. Is a trapeze movement?
Yeah, it's a trapeze act where a flyer swings off, what they call a flyer, swings off on a fly bar, a trapeze bar, from a pedestal board, does a trick into the hands of a catcher who's hanging upside down by another trapeze. And so then they swing out and back. He returns them to the fly bar and back to the pedestal board, hence the term flying return, which is characteristic of, like, the most characteristic circus trapeze act.
I can almost hear music as you're describing
that.
Yes,
you know, that, yeah.
Here comes the flying trapeze.
Yeah, it smelled of sawdust.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Everything. Yeah.
Now, Steve, give us an idea. I mean, but we're talking about a circus that was generated, I won't say locally, but regionally, and it was big stuff. I mean, it was very, very big attraction.
Ringling Brothers came out of Baraboo, Wisconsin. That was their home winter quarters. And there were a number of sites in Illinois that were winter quarters for circus performers, training quarters. So as I started researching the Bloomington circus history, I started finding some of these different places in Illinois. Petersburg was a huge circus center. Quincy was the home of the W.W. Cole Circus. Then there was Danville, Salem, Illinois. And Galesburg, way back in the 1860s, was kind of the roots of much or most of Illinois circus activity.
And these circuses would go national? I mean, they would be emanate from the towns you just mentioned, but they'd go all over.
Yes. They started out in the 1860s and 70s as small little wagon shows, and they'd go out to these farming communities in Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, Indiana, and circulate. Back in those days, transportation was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
In 1867, a guy named James T. Johnson came to Galesburg with this little wagon show, and he had the idea of establishing ring barns, practice barns, in Galesburg, Burlington, Quincy, and Macomb, and traveling up and down, presumably up and down the CB&Q Railroad, which made sense. And he planned to do this in the wintertime when they ordinarily wouldn't be traveling during the tending season, and they could make money during the winter. And he had his own little circus, but he was a great showman, but a terrible businessman. He went broke over and over, and other people bought out all of his equipment at the end of every season. His investors would start a new circus. So there were as many as, I think, seven different little circuses that came out of Galesburg.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it brought some of the greatest circus talent in the country to under his sphere of activity in Galesburg. But one of them was a young guy named Harry Lampkin, who had run away from home at Petersburg, Illinois, and he became a great performer himself. He took his circus, he went back to Petersburg and built a ring barn there, which wasn't a particular circus itself, but trained different people. He married into a big family of horseback riders, the Lawanda family, and they all came back to Petersburg and trained in his ring barn there. He died in 1886, and his brother, Edward Shipp, took over the ring barn there and began to train people. Some of the trapeze people from Bloomington wintered there and went back to Bloomington with the idea of training people in the YMCA there in Bloomington. Then when they built the YMCA in 1907, then they started to organize so that people could train through the winter in the YMCA gymnasium. And that was one of the reasons that Bloomington became a huge center of training for trapeze in particular.
Hmm. Now, did Peoria take advantage of some of that? I guess it was an audience.
There were
people
from Peoria that went into the circus and actually performed in the YMCA circus that they had every spring before the performers went out on the road.
Hmm.
And there were a few people from Peoria there, but the main thing about Peoria, which was a kind of an unrelated topic was a Wild West show that originated here. A short article was published in Peoria Magazine back in September.
My article.
About the Young Buffalo Wild West show. And that was kind of a separate thing. But Wild West is really closely related to circus.
I was going
to
say, did it compete for the same audience, or would it have come at a different time?
It kind of competed a little bit, kind of a variety show.
Right.
Jugglers, wire walkers, trapeze, horseback riders. The Wild West show was like a presentation of this sensational, almost like a stage act presented out in the open.
Right.
You know, but one whole, like they'd have the holdup of the stagecoach and the covered wagons going west, and you know, it was all centered around the myth of the American West, they actually, I think, created that myth. One great Wild West showman, Pawnee Bill, Gordon Lilly was his name, but he called himself Pawnee Bill, was born and raised in Bloomington. Then he later joined with Buffalo Bill, Cody, and they had a Wild West show of their own called the Two Bills Show. And they were the largest Wild West show ever.
Pretty successful, I would imagine.
Yes, very successful. Yeah. But the Wild West was kind of waning in the early 1900s when this guy, the Chicago entrepreneur, came down to Peoria and he established Alfresco Park.
Oh, yeah.
And
right there on the river.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he brought in a Wild West show to work there, or originated one. And then he started taking it out on the road, and that became the Young Buffalo Wild West show. And he brought in some of the greatest Wild West talent in the country.
Steve Gossard is a former curator of special collections at Illinois State University's Milner Library. He talked about Illinois' circus history and other touring shows. He talked with Steve Tarter. Students having phones in schools. Some think it's a problem. We'll hear more about it. That's on the way. This is Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This fall, the Hinckley Big Rock School District joined the growing phone-free schools movement. The district banned cell phones at the high school and middle school, hoping it would help students both socially and academically. How has it worked so far? Peter Medlin tells us.
One thing everyone has noticed is that with cell phones banned, the lunchroom and hallways are definitely louder now. Usually that's not framed as a good thing by school administrators, but in this case, it is. It means they're talking to each other instead of silently scrolling. Hinckley Big Rock Junior Matthew Patal feels the difference.
Having the conversations with other friends is just great, especially from stuff outside of school, like sports from the other night or something like that.
But louder lunchrooms aren't the only reason they made this decision and bought magnetically sealed Yonder bags for students to lock their phones in. Superintendent Jessica Sontag says that most of their discipline incidents stemmed from cell phone issues like social media drama and bullying. And one semester in, she says that's changed.
We are significantly lower. We have only had 3 out-of-school suspensions this year at the high school and 2 at the middle school. And last year, it was significantly more. And students were out of class significantly more, processing the drama that had occurred through Snapchat or texting or Instagram, and just super unavailable for learning or socialization.
She says their principals have attributed that drop in office referrals directly to the phone ban. They've also had fewer students miss school for mental health-related concerns, but Sontag says it's harder to tie that totally to the phone policy. The superintendent also hoped that because students are less distracted in class, their new phone rules would lead to improved academic outcomes. And so far, she says, it's too early to tell, but there weren't seismic shifts.
Academic data is still coming in from our first semester. I think that we did see an improvement at the middle school level. It's looking like we did not yet see an improvement in the high school academic data.
There are also aspects of the change that are more difficult to measure. It's harder to say students are X percent less distracted in class or whatever percent less stressed. Savannah McMurtry is a junior at HBR.
I would say there's a lot less distractions because you're not constantly thinking about, oh, who texted me, or wanting to scroll on Instagram a ton. And you're focused on your schoolwork, or when you're done with it, you can talk with your peers and just, honestly, it's just a lot more relaxing.
The ban actually doesn't just cover phones. They also ban smartwatches and AirPods, too. And McMurtry has seen how that impacts her teachers, too.
I remember tons of kids having AirPods in, and then the teachers constantly have to repeat themselves because the students didn't hear what they said.
She says that has not been the case this year. Alex Xavier Casanis is another HBR junior who says he does notice a little bit of a difference in the overall culture of the school.
I've seen more students go out of their way to like build a friendship with one another. And I think even one person can change someone's mood, so I could see how the students look happier.
Now, does everyone like the rule? Absolutely not. But Kasana says most have accepted it.
I think after like a month or so, they just took it as is, and there's nothing they can really do about it. I don't think their mindset, their opinion or mindset has changed on it, but their social behavior, I think, is a lot better.
Does everyone follow the rule? Well, like most rules, not everyone. McMurtry says she still sees a few people on their phone every day, in the bathroom or in the locker room. At the beginning of the year, Sontag says they had a few students plant dummy phones in their Yonder bag. A few students tried to destroy the bag to get at their phone, but she says,
we've only had one detention that happened this week. So we've made it this far into the school year with our students being that compliant with it.
She says staff are 100% in on the ban. And Sontag says she's also heard from a few parents that their kids are coming home less emotionally drained and are finding more time to finish homework at school since they're not scrolling. The district is still weighing potential tweaks to the rule. High schoolers can put their phones in their locker or in their car instead of the Yonder bag, and they're considering whether they need to tighten those rules for next year so more students aren't sneaking their phones into the bathroom. But tweaks aside, Sontag says the phone ban is going even better than she expected.
They seem happier, they seem less anxious, they seem less stressed, they seem more present.
One semester in, loud hallways and all, they have no plans of going back. I'm Peter Medlin.
Black Illinois legislators want reparations for descendants of enslaved African Americans. State Representative Sonia Harper's bill would require businesses seeking contracts with the state to disclose any historical ties to slavery. The businesses who benefited from the slave trade would also have to contribute to a fund. Harper, a Democrat from Chicago, got emotional at a press conference this week.
I continue to experience and live the results of what we went through in slavery, the results of systemic racism, right? I live in a food desert community. I go to the sleep to the sound of gunshots most night. I cannot find a healthy restaurant.
In 2021, the town of Evanston became the first U.S. city to pay reparations to black residents. Well, next on Statewide, we'll head to Chicago with Stephen Kaleo of World Cafe, part of the Sense of Place series.
Chicago is home to world-class cultural institutions like the Field Museum, Art Institute, and Chicago Symphony Orchestra, grand buildings filled with immaculately displayed objects. One of the city's newest museums has a decidedly different approach.
So this is my drum kit. Killing Joke, Ministry, Nine Inch Nails, Pigface. I failed to destroy that drum kit in the last 3 decades. I challenge anybody to have a go ahead, you know.
Welcome to the Museum of Post-Punk and Industrial Music, located in an undisclosed, nondescript building on the south side of Chicago. And today I'm being given a tour by its creator and curator, Martin Atkins, who spent decades playing in bands like Public Image Limited, Nine Inch Nails, Killing Joke, Ministry, and founded Pigface, a supergroup featuring hundreds of collaborators. He's a bit of a punk rock mad scientist.
This is a museum of post-punk and industrial music, which I started 18, 19, 20 months ago here in Chicago, which I think you would argue is the home of industrial music for sure. It's the reason I moved here in 1989, was that energy from industrial.
You didn't want this to be a traditional museum. Like, what was the mission statement in your head? What was the ideal when you were thinking this up?
Well, when you say what was the mission statement, you're implying that there was a plan. I mean, and there just wasn't.
But there was Martin's DIY attitude, which has driven him as a musician, artist, set designer, teacher, and author. During COVID, he was looking at his collection of memorabilia and knew now was the time to preserve it, the only way he knew how.
We didn't ask for permission. I'm like, oh my goodness, that sounds very punk. You know, oh my goodness, I am living the words we used to say.
You know what else is punk? Where Martin put the museum.
It used to be a funeral home. If you like industrial and funerals, yeah.
And a lot of people like industrial. Using rock music with electronic rhythms and a mechanical sound, it took root in Chicago in the 1980s. It's what brought Martin to the Windy City, thanks to the influential early record label, Wax Trax.
I wanted my band Pigface to be on Wax Trax. I came to Chicago to work with Ministry on the Cage tour and sat in a studio and then hung out with Albini and had Jesus Lizard do their second ever show on my roof. Like, what the heck? It was like 1976 London. Energy in Chicago then was so special. Weather was still horrible, but the energy was huge.
Despite the weather, the scene that Wax Trax helped foster started attracting people who would make Chicago and industrial music synonymous.
So many people were magnetized here. Nesh from KMFDM, you know, people were just drawn to that. So once you create this magnet, and then Front 242 and all of these other people, Frontline Assembly, Skinny Puppy, all these people are coming here. You throw in Cabaret Metro and this support system, and it's exponential.
It was a collection of like-minded weirdos that included a young Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails.
To be the only person somewhere that looks a certain way or has a certain idea, that's difficult. I think Trent grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania somewhere. You know, the north of England was difficult to be a punk, you know, where I grew up and then moved to London. And I was fortunate enough to see it as an outsider, to see it having experienced punk and post-punk in London. I recognized awesomeness and adrenaline and creativity. And so I'm like, well, I don't know what's going on, but I'm gonna move into the middle of it.
And Chicago was the perfect place for an industrial music museum alongside its close sibling. Martin, with his connections to several seminal bands, was the right person to get it off the ground.
It wasn't a crusade. I wasn't keeping stuff to put in a museum. I just kept everything. And I could have put that just on display, but that would have been the museum of Martin Atkins. My mom might have liked that, but how sad would that have been?
And thanks to a little help, Martin has amassed quite the collection.
I want to say there's 3,000 pieces in the building, maybe 6 or 7.
How many pieces are these of the museum is from your personal collection?
A year ago, 98%.
Okay.
Now, and the thing I love about it, now we're at about 60%.
The Museum of Post-Punk and Industrial Music might not be the largest space, but it's crammed floor to ceiling with concert scenery, pictures, t-shirts, tour posters, platinum records, stickers, buttons, and so much more. Major bands of the era receive their own mini shrines. Downstairs, there's a recording studio where you can remix one of Pigface's songs and take home a cassette copy of your own personal version. There are also a few contributions from fans that surprised even Martin.
The bongos over there, they're Paul Raven's bongos. He's been gone 14 years now. But somebody said to me, oh, I've got Killing Joke's bongos. And I'm thinking to myself, there aren't any, you know? And I want to send an email that says, nice try, F you. But I'm learning at last to dial it down a bit. So my response was, really, tell me more. It's like, well, Paul Raven used to come to the house and these were his bongos. He'd pick them up and play these bongos and put his stickers on them and tell stories. I'm like, oh my goodness, please send them to me. So all of these items start to reverberate for me. It's like when you listen to a song that was important to you, your memory kicks off. This place triggers these memories for people and puts them in that loop.
That person being triggered by those memories? That's me. I grew up with industrial and post-punk music. Nine Inch Nails and Joy Division are two of my favorite bands. So I was in the loop when Martin decided to take me over to one of his favorite objects.
I want to show you this for so many reasons. This is an album.
Sandpaper.
You can also do your nails here at the museum. This is a band called Durruti Column on Factory Records in 1980. So the legend has it that members of Joy Division were drunk at the Factory Records office, gluing sandpaper to these albums. And the idea is, it's so punk. You put it into your collection, take it out, put it in, ow, take it out, right? And it slowly destroys the album to the left and the right. And I'm like, oh, this is so punk. It's so passive aggressive. It's like Neil Young, Rust Never Sleeps, right? We're destroying your entire collection.
A musical nod to Guy Debord's memories. Martin has a knack for turning the mundane into the memorable.
Well, some members of large bands would like, oh, I've lost my pass. No, you didn't. You gave it to somebody because we wouldn't give you any more guest lists. So you have everybody sign for their passes. So you've got this insane bureaucracy within a crazy band with no restrictions, except you have to sign for your passes on a Tuesday. And so thank goodness Jolly Roger had people sign. Now I've got this 35 signatures on this one page. So instead of railing against that bureaucracy, I'm like, fantastic.
I have a signature wall now.
Yeah.
All of these pieces, Atkins worked to collect and preserve, and he wondered, how do you go about sharing it? He knew he didn't want it to be a traditional museum.
These throbbing gristle buttons from 1976 are so rare. Signed pieces, lots of pieces from people who aren't with us anymore. But instead of closing the doors and protecting the stuff, the way to protect the vibe is to let people in. So we did pop-up haircuts, you know, so there's hair all over the floor, which is not museum 101. We did a whiskey pancake brunch for people to sit and, like, never mind the museum. What about, you want some more pancakes? So, and then you kind of stumble into what I like about punk and post-punk and industrial music, which is this doing things differently, rolling up your sleeves and making things happen and involving the audience in it.
And if there was going to be a museum, it was going to be a group effort. And early signs showed that support was there.
Very quickly, 100, 200 people, like, yes, we're in. And that keeps happening. 18 months in, it's still happening. And now 1,200 people are founders of the museum. But before this room existed, that's a leap of faith. That's trust. That's community. It's all the things that, you know, better than a 10-page agreement will make anybody, especially me, put 10 times the effort in than I would if I was being forced to do something. So when the community does that, it's like, oh, that's great.
It's an entirely DIY undertaking.
We haven't received a cent from the city of Chicago. That will come later. But we just made this happen, which is a very different conversation than waiting for permission from people who will want to then go suggest no pancakes, no haircuts.
Martin sees the museum not just as a celebration of music, but a celebration of a city that helped make that music possible, welcoming everyone to put their signature on a wall that's traditionally been defined as hands-off, making a gallery space more democratic, less precious. In a lot of ways, that's what Chicago is all about.
This is Chicago, it's why I'm here. When you're here, the community comes together and lifts everybody up. It's a roll up your sleeves thing, and everybody's helping each other, you know? That's Chicago.
And that is Martin Atkins, a one-of-a-kind Chicagoan who invites you to go to his museum and get your hands dirty.
This enables us to talk to people about creativity. If you're trying to come up with an idea, you'll never come up with an idea. I like to tell people, come here, eat all the crayons, and just see what you f*** out. And of course, you can bleep the hell out of that.
To find out how you can visit the Museum of Post-Punk and Industrial Music, find details at martinatkins.com. For Sense of Place Chicago, I'm Kaleo. This is World Cafe.
Thanks to World Cafe and Stephen Kaleo for that segment. You're listening to Statewide. We've got more ahead. Stay right here. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A 40-year-old law has protected millions of acres of wetlands on U.S. farm ground, but a company that owns land in Iowa says the law violates private property rights and is suing the USDA. And as Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, the lawsuit could upend a major wetlands conservation policy.
At the Center for Agricultural Law and Taxation at Iowa State University, Director Christine Tidgren scrolls through the 1985 Farm Bill on her computer. She's looking for a section called Wetland Conservation.
So right in here is where it is.
Farmers, policymakers, and conservationists call this law Swamp Buster.
When Swamp Buster was enacted and put into law, there were concerns about preserving wetlands across the country.
By the mid-80s, over half of the original wetlands in the lower 48 states had been lost, largely through agricultural drainage. And people were worried. Wetlands provide vital habitat for wildlife, filter drinking water, and store floodwater. Tidgren says Swamp Buster aimed to protect what was left by linking conservation to federal benefits, like crop insurance and farm loans.
The idea was that if you did then convert those wetlands to farmland, then you would be denied a proportion of some of your farm benefits.
Today, farmers that drain, fill in, or alter designated wetlands on their land risk losing all farm subsidies. Swamp Buster has helped slow down the disappearance of wetlands in the U.S. But now, the long-standing law is being challenged in federal court. The case stems from 72 acres in northeastern Iowa owned by CTM Holdings, a company that rents out farmland. Jim Conlin is CTM's managing member.
It is very fertile, tillable soil, and it has spots in it that the government designated as wetland. And as a result, the trees can't be removed from it. It can't be used for anything, and they pay nothing for that.
When the USDA denied his request to reevaluate the wetland designation, Conlin, a retired Chicago attorney, says he started looking into Swamp Buster.
And the closer I read the statute, the more I said, this is crazy. This is clearly unconstitutional.
CTM's lawsuit argues that Congress did not have the authority to pass Swamp Buster and that it infringes on private property rights. Lauren C. Hayes with Liberty Justice Center is one of the attorneys for CTM.
Normally, when the government says, hey, I'm doing something for everybody, a public use, a public purpose, then it's a taking. They use the powers of eminent domain to take the property and they provide just compensation to the property owners.
But the USDA, along with a group of sustainable ag organizations intervening in the case, argue that Swamp Buster does not take or regulate land. It's part of congressional spending, which can come with conditions.
The thing that is very puzzling to me about plaintiff's argument is that they're basically arguing that farmers should be entitled to free taxpayer money with no strings attached.
That's Katie Garvey, a staff attorney with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, which is representing the Iowa Farmers Union in the case. Garvey says farmers who leave designated wetlands in place get access to subsidies worth billions of dollars.
The government's not taking anything from anybody. They're saying they have opened up a giant pot of money and they said, come and get it. Who wants it? Do you want it? Okay, here's the one thing you need to do in order to get it.
The lawsuit over wetland conservation is expected to go to trial this year. It comes on the heels of several U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have made it easier to challenge environmental laws and the federal agencies that carry them out. This includes the Sackett decision, which sharply limited the EPA's authority to regulate pollution released into wetlands and streams under the Clean Water Act. Michael Schmidt is an attorney with the Iowa Environmental Council, one of the organizations intervening in the Swamp Buster case.
Swamp Buster is one of the few conditions that we have in Iowa and nationwide addressing agricultural pollution and reducing agricultural pollution.
He says getting rid of the lawn standing law would be a move in the wrong direction. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
It started with a handful of incarcerated men having huddled conversations about writing inside the Dixon Correctional Center in Northern Illinois. Over the years, it's grown into the Mud Theater Project in Chicago. Many founders have since made their way out of prison and onto one of the most prestigious stages in the city. Mike Davis takes us behind the scenes of the new play, Searching for Justice.
1 year, 2 years, 3 years.
In an intimate black box theater in Bridgeport, actors rehearse lines.
1 year, 2 years, 3 years, every single one of those kids deserves.
Mud Theater was founded in the Dixon Correctional Center in 2018, known at that time as Dixon Theater Workshop, when the facility's chaplain gave the incarcerated men the opportunity to write and stage a play.
For me, the object was to get beyond the wall with our stories while we're inside.
Brian Beals is co-founder and executive director of Mud Theater. He says the group's initial experience with theater while incarcerated was illuminating.
When we actually got to learning about what theater was and the impact that it had on the guys in the system, like being able to meet up and rage without repercussion, to have emotion in the fellowship of men and brothers, I was like, all right, we got something going here.
The group went on to write and perform plays and even nabbed awards from PEN America for its writing. The company's new play, Searching for Justice, examines a justice system that sends so many youth to prison. It's one of the final rehearsals before a one-night-only show at Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater. Actor Darion Benson plays a politician who's become jaded about the possibility of reforming the prison system. And he admits he's a little nervous about the upcoming show as he speaks about getting into character.
We don't imagine politicians to be this emotional, so that was the difficult part. How do I act and not be so sentimental? And I think I'm getting there. I get a lot of like, yeah, you did a good job, but you know, as a writer, as somebody who wants to get it right, I always got that thing in my mind like, I could do better.
In real life, Benson is still in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections. He's participating in the production while on work release. The big night arrives, and the theater at Steppenwolf is packed to the rafters. After pre-show hugs, handshakes, and acknowledgments from organizers, the show gets started.
I present to you Searching for Justice.
At the beginning of the play, Benson's character has a journalist friend confront him about letting his personal ambitions get in the way of criminal justice reform.
I think that you're scared of not being reelected. I think
that could be worse people in the seat than me.
But by the end, Benson finds himself center stage in front of the sold-out audience and delivers a gripping monologue where he promises to put his career on the line to serve his constituents.
I'm here to help the power distribute equal. Ensure harmful laws don't have a sequel until I'm voted out. I'm gonna fight for the people.
For lead playwright Toussaint Daniels, the success of the show is a team effort.
It's surreal to seeing the things that works in your mind manifest into reality. And to make it even more surreal is because everybody has sacrificed in order to make the story go forward, not only my story, but it's truly our story.
After the show, Brian Beals talked about the hard work that went into creating a theater program from scratch. But he said the hardest thing he'd have to do that night was drive actor Darion Benson back to his correctional facility by his 10 o'clock curfew. Mike Davis, WBEZ News.
Illinois is one of 17 states that has severely restricted or eliminated parole for those who are incarcerated. The state abolished its parole system in 1978. Prior to that, a board could let people out before completing their sentence. But as Emily Hayes reports, things could change during this year's state legislative session.
Joseph Dole was one of about a dozen students facing a group of lawmakers in March of 2018.
I don't have any public speaking experience, so I was a little bit nervous.
The students were in teams, each arguing for the most effective way to bring parole back to Illinois. They had read many law journal articles, legal cases, and studies.
The most shocking part for us was that we thought they would be more informed than we were, and it was actually the opposite.
But this wasn't an ordinary high school or college debate class, and these were not typical students. All are serving life sentences in prison.
The people who showed up, almost every one of them said, you know, it wasn't so much the arguments we were making, like those are all valid arguments, but the fact that you guys are up there and so knowledgeable and composed and, you know, it just like destroys the stereotype. And that is more powerful than the actual arguments that you could ever make.
Dole was convicted of murder in 2000 based on a state law that holds people accountable for the actions of others. He has maintained his innocence. Raul Dorado was convicted of murder in the same year under the same law.
What we have now, we have a determinate sentencing scheme where you give people a fixed sentence. There's no reviewing their progress throughout the sentence.
The state does have a prisoner review board, but they only get involved after the sentence is complete. It's why Dorado and the class drafted legislation that would allow those in prison a chance to turn their work, education, and disciplinary history while incarcerated into freedom. It's known as the Earned Reentry Bill. He argues it's safer to give those in prison a reason to improve themselves.
After 20 years, you're eligible to present your best self before the Illinois Prisoner Review Board and plead your case for relief. And it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. You have to meet certain criteria.
At first, the class tried working with one lawmaker to get the legislation passed. But Dole says she made changes to it that they didn't like. They then gave it to Urbana Representative Carol Ammons.
I've been involved in criminal justice reform for almost 20 years.
Before joining the General Assembly in 2015, Ammons ran the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center and its Books to Prisoners program. She says the state would save money by keeping fewer people in prison.
Statistically and numerically, crime is down. And so do we need the level of facilities that we have in the state? Perhaps we don't. If we had an parole system, we probably would not, which saves the taxpayers significant money.
Ammons has been working on the Earned Reentry Bill for 3 years. She says some of the delay is making sure the change will roll out smoothly.
And the other part of that is the Prisoner Review Board, which is, I think, has experienced some instability for a number of years. Certainly in the last 3 years, we've been trying to pass this bill. And that instability makes it difficult for us to implement the bill.
The bill also has critics. Jennifer Bishop Jenkins is a prominent victim's family advocate who doesn't think all parole cases should be left up to the review board.
There are psychopathic serial killers. There are people who are not safe. And unfortunately, sadly, my sister's killer is one of them.
Her sister was 25 and pregnant when she and her husband were killed in their home by a teenager. Despite the crime, Bishop Jenkins is against capital punishment. She helped end the death penalty in Illinois in 2011 in favor of a life without parole.
To put any body of human beings that are not, you know, psychiatrists and, experts in sociopathic personality disorders and psychopathic diagnoses and things like that, nobody else should be making that decision.
In the years following the class debate, Raul Dorado and Joseph Dole founded a nonprofit called Parole Illinois. And they and the others who wrote the bill oppose excluding any group of incarcerated people.
Remember, it's not a jail get out of jail free card. You still have to go up before a conservative board, but at least it would act as a safety valve for all the overly punitive laws we've passed over the last 4 or 5 decades and give a guys a chance to, you know, put forth their case that they've served enough time or they can be safely released or safely allowed to reunite with their families.
Carol Ammons says the Prisoner Review Board did receive more money from the state last year, which she thinks will help increase support for the Earned Reentry Bill.
The PRB has to be adequately staffed, as well as the members of the PRB need to be stabilized so that they can look at these issues. They would have to have a certain amount of hearings, and those need to be done on a regular basis.
If the bill passes, about 4,000 people would be eligible because they've already served 20 years of their sentence. That's according to Department of Corrections data from last September. I'm Emily Hayes.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks once again for being with us, and join us next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from here in Illinois and across the Midwest. You can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.